This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Okay, I think we'll start off today with a literary gem from Jim Lamb. If we do that, then I'm waiting for a call in from somebody who's really fascinating. Egyptologist. You know, I love Egyptology. I was, one of the things that I was thinking of doing when I was young was to become an Egyptologist. And as a matter of fact, I spent many, many hours in the reading room at the British Library studying Egyptology. So I'm looking forward to this call. But do we have the Jim Lamb literary gem ready? And we're going to play that first, and we're going to wait in for Kara Cooney to call in.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the Joker in Batman. Each is an antagonist. When it comes to storytelling, each brings something special to the table. I'm Jim Lamb. Let's get started. An antagonist represents a roadblock, an obstacle, a challenge. He or she or it stands in the protagonist's way, keeping them from reaching their goal. Antagonists are often villains, like the bad guys who take on James Bond, Oddjob, Goldfinger, and Jaws, the towering assassin with steel teeth. An antagonist doesn't have to be a person, however. It might be an organization like Spectre, Hydra, or Chaos. Or it could just be a bunch of flying monkeys out to ruin the hero's day. The prime purpose of antagonists is to bring conflict to the story. Sometimes the antagonist is a friend, like Iago in Shakespeare's Othello. Sometimes it's a snake, like Satan in the Garden of Eden. Sometimes it's your biggest fan, like Annie Wilkes in Stephen King's Misery. Here are some other examples. Norman Bates in Psycho, Darth Vader in Star Wars, Mr. Potter in It's a Wonderful Life. My favorite antagonist is Harry Lime in The Third Man, but I also like The Alien in Alien, The Terminator in Terminator, and Bonnie and Clyde in Bonnie and Clyde. You could say there were two antagonists in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the doctor and the monster, because, let's face it, both were monsters in their own way. What about Herman Melville's Moby Dick? Who was the real villain, Captain Ahab or the White Whale? Speaking of captains, consider Captain Bligh in Mutiny on the Bounty, Captain Queeg in Caine Mutiny, and Captain Hook in Peter Pan. You might ask, why must our hero face so many problems? Great question. Here's why. Because a good guy like Sherlock Holmes must bump into a really bad guy like Professor Moriarty to find out just how good he really is. Know what I mean? I'm Jim Lamb, and you just learned a little something-something about antagonists.
Okay, great. That is a course from Jim Lamb, and that's one of his literary gems that he is doing for everybody who is, well, who is writing, and particularly for all of you people doing NaNoWriMo this month. All of you need some support and some assistance and some guidance, and you can find that right there on my website, Radio-Joy on Paper, and go to the page, it's marked Jim Lamb, Literary Gems, and you can go there, and he has all sorts of suggestions of things that you should know, elements of writing that make your writing interesting. So I hope that you will check that out. And he's going to be, you know, I've been looking at the elements of writing, and I think we have perhaps about 60 or 70 that are really important for you to know if you are a writer. And it's sometimes, it's funny, even people who have been writing for years sometimes don't know what they're writing. They can write, but they don't perhaps understand exactly what it is or what they can call what they're writing. And sometimes people are shy to ask. But with Jim Lamb, he is so supportive of writers. He loves writers. He loves to help writers. And so we came out with these literary gems, and I am just so grateful to him for doing these for us almost every week we have one. And as I said, we have about 60 or 70 to go, and it's lots of fun to hear him do this, and he enjoys it. And if you are a writer, check it out. And if you're not a writer, why not? Just, you know, ask yourself, why am I not writing? Because there's a story in all of us. And so I hope that you will just one day it just come to you and you say, oh, I can do it. And it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter your background. You might not have been good in school at all. You might have, you know, never paid attention to some of your classes. But, you know, sometimes it is really, I have discovered this with so many of the people that I have talked to over this almost 7 years now on Joy on Paper. Sometimes people have surprised themselves. They are thrilled. They start writing and they, you know, sort of say, oh, I'll do a paragraph. I'll do a paragraph. And then words start coming out, and then they might do a page. And then they say, well, you know, I've done a page. And it's not always that it is, you don't need a typewriter, you don't need a computer. All you have to do is get a notebook, a piece of paper, and a pencil. You don't even need a fancy gel pen. You can just sit there and start writing. Because just think about it, how many writers just wrote from the heart and were just writing like crazy long time before we had computers and typewriters. Think of Tolstoy. My goodness, when you imagine that, when you think about how many pages his books are, and hundreds of pages, and even current authors, you know, modern day authors, Margaret George, who wrote the wonderful book Cleopatra, and her other book that I just love, it's so beautiful, Henry VIII. I think it is the best, absolutely the best book about Henry VIII, because it is written actually in the first person, like as if Henry VIII was writing it himself. And I love that book. It is so much fun to read. And it is, I think, 692 pages. And she wrote that book by hand, just on a regular notebook paper. She sat down at her kitchen table and started writing, and she went, she got into it. And she just kept writing, and it was so funny. When I went to meet her she invited me up to her home in Wisconsin, and I went to her home, and she made me this lovely, lovely tea, you know, a proper British tea with salmon sandwiches, and it was absolutely wonderful. And I asked, you know, about this. I hadn't realized that she had written it by hand. And she still has it. She had it up in the attic. And I said, you better get that thing down, because that's like a collector's item. Not too many authors can say they have a 692-page book that they've written by hand. And in fact, she wrote it twice, because when she rewrote it, the first time she edited it, she rewrote it. So she has two copies of this fantastic book. Which in so many ways, I think having a handwritten book is so nice, because you can see exactly how the author developed, how they grew as they were writing it. One of the most fascinating things that you can ever do is to go to Princeton and see F. Scott Fitzgerald's original writing, the stories as he wrote them. There's a library there, and everything that he wrote, and you see the changes. You see what word is, you know, crossed out, what changes were made. And I've done that for quite a few authors. I've been able to, as I do, I always visit libraries, and I visit the homes of authors. I've been doing that wherever I've traveled. And so I was really thrilled always to find an author's home near where I was traveling, and I would visit it, sort of make a pilgrimage, which is what I started my life in England as. My when I moved to England, it was really a pilgrimage to live somewhere near Jane Austen. And I had decided that when I was 11 years old that I was going to live near where Jane Austen was born. But it's so much fun to see where they lived and then to see their original writing, which is so often showcased in these in their homes when you can find them. For example, Jane Austen, it's amazing when you see her writing. It gives you a thrill. There's Darcy on paper written in her own hand. It's quite amazing. And I did the same, of course, with Charlotte, with the Brontes, all of the Brontes. I went up to their home. I am so happy when I look back on it, you know, when I was young and I became obsessed with Jane Austen. I'm so glad I became obsessed with her rather than Charlotte Bronte, because that would have been a terrible place to live. Their home is in the north. And it's a terrible, cold and miserable country, other than, you know, she writes about it in the book and it sounds all beautiful and purple heather. But in point of fact, it's pretty cold and it's usually it's sort of gray. So I was happy that I moved to near where Jane Austen. I could take the back roads and just drive from my house to Jane Austen's house where she was born. And the house itself wasn't there anymore, but the grounds are there and other things are there. And I would just mostly picnic there because it was so wonderful. I'm just waiting, you know, again here. I don't know if you heard this little buzzing sound. I have buzzing sound waiting for this author who's supposed to call me today. But, you know, this is live radio, so you never know what's going to happen. And I'm just waiting to see if Kara Cooney will call in, because her book is fascinating. It's all about, well, Egypt in a way that very few people have approached it, and the talk about the last pharaohs. And so I'm looking forward to her, if she ever calls in. If not, I've got other people coming. One of the things that just in case, you know, Big Ed, I have a playlist. I don't know if you people have playlists that you play sort of songs at certain times in your life or certain moments, even like I have a morning playlist and I have an evening playlist. And then I have a few other playlists for different things. One of the songs that is on my morning playlist is Boxcar. And this song really, when I listen to it, I get so, I just feel so good when I listen to Boxcar. And I was so happy that, you know, I added this sort of to my repertoire. There's quite a few songs they play, including the F-105 Thud song. So, you know, Ed, let's pull up Boxcar, because Ed is right there in the control room and he can get into these things. Do you have that? Oh, maybe the phone is ringing and maybe Kara is calling. We will hope. We will hope, because I want to talk to her about this. Kara, are you there?
I'm sorry, I got confused.
Okay, well, we all get confused these days. I go around some days, I'm not sure. I actually, one day, I was sort of really calm one morning, not doing too much, thinking, you know, I've got little things I can do. And then I realized, my gosh, it's a Tuesday. I've got a program.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but I am so glad, because actually, in many ways, I'm turning this time over to you, because you are talking to the choir. Let's say you're so many parts of what you want to talk about. Are things that I've thought over the years. And I will preface this by saying I lived in the Middle East for a long time. I lived particularly in Iran for a long time. I traveled around. I went to so many fantastic places. And I had actually, as a young girl, I too had dreamt about being an Egyptologist, but I went in another direction, but I have been to a lot of digs. I have been to a lot of sites. So I'm going to let you tell. You know, you're the professor here. You're the expert.
But go ahead and, you know, interrupt and put your questions in there.
Oh, I will. I interrupt. You can't stop me.
How long a segment?
Well, it's a little shorter than I wanted, but I think what we'll do, let's go ahead and we'll talk about the book, The Good Kings, Absolute Power in Ancient Egypt and the Modern World. And then you can explain, if you want, the kings that you selected, and you can explain this whole theory that, or this thing that has... the idea, the concept that has grabbed you, okay?
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
Oh, so my name's Kara Cooney, and I wrote a book called The Good Kings. And in this book, I'm trying to get my colleagues to treat ancient Egypt more critically and get the world to see ancient Egypt more critically. We celebrate these kings. We consume their blockbuster exhibitions. But we don't always compare their power to ours. We see their power as very different from ours. And I wanted to burst that bubble of modern exceptionalism, if the virus hasn't done it for you already, and try to equate our world and our patriarchal systems with those of ancient Egypt.
So you came at it this way. You identified five particular kings that you want to talk about, right? And then we want to talk about the whole idea of power, manpower.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yep. So I chose five kings. The five are Khufu, and then I have some Senwosert III of Dynasty 12, Akhenaten of Dynasty 18, Ramses II of Dynasty 19, and Taharqa of Dynasty 25. And each of them have different ruling strategies and different ways of trying to control their elites or their people or prove their power. But each of them shares what we call patriarchal systems. This idea that men rule best, that the rule of the fathers and controlling people and populations is the way things should work. And I chose each of these kings because they're at the top of a wave, if you like. And everything seems so powerful and perfect as if nothing could ever change. And it's at exactly those moments when the men in power are sowing the seeds for their own destruction. And so in each of these cases, and we have 2,000 years of history in this book, you see the patriarchy growing and smashing and grabbing and then failing and then remaking itself and then growing and smashing and grabbing and then failing. And each time they reconstitute, the system gets bigger. It includes more people and a broader society. They say it's fairer each time, but each time it's the same, just bigger. And each time the collapse is bigger. And I argue by the end of the book that we are still engaged in this rinse and repeat cycle, and that our collapse will be bigger than ever before. And will we actually, which I think we're going through right now, and will we actually be able to reconstitute this smash-and-grab system with an earth that has been made so fragile after the last 10,000 years of patriarchal system?
Okay. Well, maybe we'll get back to the kings. But let's talk about this whole concept of patriarchal systems. Okay. We have, you know, they built all these pyramids and all to themselves for, you know, to tell us and to remind us of who they are, and that we have this throughout history. Now you, of course, don't want all this torn down, I hope, right? You don't want us to get...
No.
Okay.
No, this is all... I think there's often a confusion about when we see a system for what it is, does that mean that we destroy it and burn it? That's not what I'm saying. You can see a pyramid for the power that it is, but that doesn't mean that you need to take it down. Indeed, I would say that those who want to burn and pillage are often other patriarchal systems. That's the way patriarchy is.
That's
you, I would suggest, thinking in a patriarchal frame of mind, that you then have to burn and take it down, when instead you can reframe and use it to remember what that system is. This is the water in which we swim right now, and that's why we think in this way.
Well, I think this is important. You know, I spent a great deal of time, and I don't know if you ever went to Iran, I spent a great deal of time at Takht-e Jamshid, which is Persepolis. And you're standing there, and you are so small. You're so tiny compared to these enormous monuments and statues that they built, and you feel so insignificant. And I know that, you know, on the one hand, it's they did so many people did terrible things, but I don't know where it's a balance. What do you hope for? Because do you really believe people are going to change?
I think people are going to change, and I'll tell you why. But first, you know, those pyramids and those monuments and those monumental statues, when you feel tiny and insignificant in front of them, that's exactly how you're supposed to feel. That is power working on your mind. And it still works on us today. That's why these structures are continuously built and then destroyed and then rebuilt. And this is the way patriarchal systems work. The reason I think that people will change is not because they will want to, but because they will be forced to. And the only reason I think they will is because the Earth will make them. Because with almost 8 billion people on this planet, you're going to try to reconstitute another smash-and-grab system that rapes and pillages from the Earth, given the amount of damage that we've caused. I don't think we can. I don't think that we have the carrying capacity. I don't think we have the resources left to give. I think that one more reconstitution could poison us all. And that's where I see things changing in a very significant way. And but if people had their way, I think we would continue in this system.
Well, who's to blame? Is it the man or is it the woman? Because the man is the son of a woman. And you know, it's like this vicious circle. Mothers create these men. And so what do we do? I mean, what do you hope? This is a problem. I mean, I absolutely understand everything you say, because I was one of, perhaps before you, because I'm a little older, but I started my own company, okay, all women, only women. I refused to have any men. The lawyer, the accountant, everything was woman. And, so I thought I was doing my bit. But now I don't know where, you know, you're the mother of a son. I'm the mother of a son. I have a wonderful husband, you know, and so who's going to start this big change?
Well, the big change has already started, and being anti-patriarchal doesn't have to do with being man-hating. It doesn't mean you can't love your sons and love your husbands. And patriarchy isn't just led by men, as you've already noted and felt. Patriarchy is led by men and women. And as a rule by the fathers, it simply means that the fathers get the professions, the best positions, and that the women and children are commodified and controlled. But when I say the change is already happening, I would encourage you to even think in non-binary sexuality and how many people are asking to be called they and them and don't identify with male or female. This is something that is very distressing to the patriarchy and older generations who do not understand it and cannot conceive that a man might be more feminized or a woman might be more masculinized. But sexuality in the human species occurs on a gradient. And as soon as patriarchal systems start to crumble a little bit, people run to the idea that they can express themselves as they are without this imposed binary. And when I say things are changing, you can see that people aren't getting married the way they used to. Everyone's shacking up if they want. People are deciding not to have kids. The amount of non-traditional lifestyles is so unsettling to patriarchal power systems that you have laws in Texas that are imposing pregnancy on women. So it's an interesting time to be alive. It's an interesting fire to walk through. And a lot of your listeners may be like, what the hell does this have to do with ancient Egypt? And I would say that Egypt allows us to see patriarchal systems much more clearly. Patriarchy is the water in which we swim. So you can't see it. It's all around you. The pharaoh's crook and flail, though, is obvious. You're like, oh, there's the patriarchy. Look at them fooling the people. But yet we don't see that the entrepreneur's suit and tie turned into a politician saying that he's a jobs creator and using the ideology of democracy, however we understand that, is the same thing.
But are you the thing is, are men inherently where do women leaders come into this? I mean, we're talking, if you look at it, there were some unbelievably strong women. You know,
there were some unbelievably strong women.
You know, Queen Victoria. All of the French queens were stronger than their stupid husbands. I think every single one of them was smarter and did things on a greater scale and ordered construction of things so much more than their idiot husbands. This particular,
I wouldn't say it that way, and I wouldn't fall into that binary. And I actually don't see the women able to build more than the men around them. It's a rare thing when a woman is able to take power, or there's weird circumstances. And when you see so many women taking power in Europe, I would argue it's because of a fragmentation and competition amongst people that looks to a bloodline first before to the next man who could rule. But I wouldn't, when a woman rules in a patriarchy, she's ruling for the patriarchy. She's not ruling for women. No female rule in history thus far has changed the system. It's just been, they've been tools to connect to more patriarchy. So I don't actually see most of that as changing things. What I see changing is the grassroots of society deciding that they're not going to participate in traditional patriarchy anymore. And it's ironic that it's capitalism that has overworked us all so that we have to have 2, 3, 4 jobs, that we aren't having the children, we aren't living together as married couples. We're not doing these traditional things because we're working too hard and we can't afford it. So the social inequality has made it so that people are opting out as well.
So we didn't get to talk about any of the particular kings. Do you want to mention just a few of them and tell my listeners why they should read and what they will discover in this book, that, you know, about Egypt in general?
Yeah, sure. So Khufu is the builder of the Great Pyramid. And you look at this pyramid, you stand in front of it and feel so small, and think maybe even human hands didn't build it. And that's exactly what that king wanted you to believe. And these pyramids still work on our minds today. But the pyramid, I argue in the book, is built because he had to build it, not because he wanted to build it. And I set the pyramid up as a symbol of the king's weakness, that he needs to create something that manufactures more power for him. Sinwasser III is the next king in the lineup, and I call him, or his chapter, The King Strikes Back. And it's all about a king working against elites who have become too strong. And it's very much a result of Khufu's reign that empowered elites by making them engineers to build his pyramid. There's a lot of long-duration history in this book. And the next king is Akhenaten, and your listeners may know Akhenaten as the first monotheist, the man who decided there was only one god, and that god was the sun in the sky. And he built temples open to the sky so that was the only icon, and he was the only way to worship that god. And the imposition of this fanatical religion was a deep scar. And, you know, I call him a good king like all of the rest. But the reason I say the good kings in this book is because I'm talking about the imposition of an ideology of morality, that these kings are the best, most necessary, most moral choice, and that we can't even see the power grab for what it is because of the way it's all cradled in an ideology of goodness. And the next king is Ramses II, and he I associate with a populace who's trying to connect with his soldiers and all of his priests, vast ranks of men, a base, if you like, whom he needs to please. And so he builds all of these colossal statues to connect with them. Well, and then the last king is... Oh, go ahead,
I'm sorry, I'm running out of time because you got on late. But, Kara, it's a fascinating book, and I want... do you have a website, someplace you want people to go to?
Yeah, you can go to Kara with a K, Cooney with a C, and you'll find my Squarespace page. And I'm on Facebook and Twitter, and I have a new podcast called Afterlives with Kara Cooney.
What's it called?
Afterlives.
Okay.
With Kara Cooney.
Okay, and the name of the book is The Good Kings, Absolute Power in Ancient Egypt and the Modern World. Okay, well, I think people, this is an eye-opening book. It's something for you to think about. And as I said, it's Egyptology is always fascinating. Don't get influenced and start believing in patriarchy after this book. I think you did a great job in explaining it. And we'll hope that things get better in this world.
Yeah, it would be nice, right?
It would be nice. And
before the peace, we get the fire.
That's it. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Okay, bye-bye now. Okay. All right, I think I'm ready. Am I ready for the next author? I am. And so we're going to do the advertisements after because we're running a little bit late. And so I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Lily Anderson, and the name of her book is The Throwback List. And I will tell you something. I sort of needed this book because I've been getting a lot of pandemic-y books, a lot of pandemic-y books. Please, people, stop with the pandemic-y books. And I needed a laugh. And there are a lot of things that made me laugh in this book. So I'm so happy to welcome Lily to the program. Hi, Lily.
Hello.
Okay, well, my goodness, The Throwback List. That's a great title. I thought that was a cool title. Well, as I said, there are some very funny things in this book. So you can tell us about the book, and then I will tell you what I particularly loved about it, okay?
Sounds good. Yeah, The Throwback List is about three girls, Joe, Autumn, and Bianca, who are all in their mid-20s, and they all end up back in their hometown after college for various reasons. When Joe comes back, she finds her high school bucket list in her childhood bedroom, and going over it, she realizes she can't tick off a single thing. For the last 10 years, she was like so focused on work and school that she just forgot to have any fun. So she enlists her high school best friend, Autumn, and Autumn's new best friend, Bianca, to tick off every item on the list.
Well, I think it's fun. And I love, there's multiple points of view in this book. So explain how you wrote it and a little bit about each of them.
Yeah, the three girls each have their own point of view in the book. I wanted to be able to show the different ways that they interact with each other and their hometown and their families, just the different ways there are to be in your late 20s. And so, I really approached it from the point of view of trying to fill in where the other characters couldn't see, show you things that you've seen before, but from a different point of view.
Well, explain about Joe and about her job and how she landed up going back home.
Yeah, Joe is a social media manager. You know, she's a millennial Zoomer, so she has a very techie online job. And so she's working in Silicon Valley at the beginning of the book. And she... her company is being acquired, and she is not part of the deal. And so she has sort of given the last 5 years of her life to this one company, but she still ends up not getting the big promotion she was hoping for and instead gets laid off.
And I loved that she had a game plan. She was going to start off as an intern, not getting any money. Then she had several levels to go through.
Right, and she gets through every level except the last one, the one that has the most security.
That's it, and lands up back in her bedroom. So you can go home again and find some amusement out of all of the mess. Right?
I certainly wanted to explore the idea of going home again. I have never been able to. When I went to college, my dad sold my childhood home. And so I've always been really jealous of people who can go home again. And so I wrote this book as sort of a panacea against that.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But
who doesn't want to go home again? And Bianca, who's never lived anywhere else, and Autumn, whose parents are selling her house.
Well, at least your dad left a forwarding address, I hope.
Yes, I could find him.
You can find him. Okay. He didn't just say, okay, she's gone. I'm out of here. Okay, that's great. Well, and you have a wonderful sense of humor. Some of it is quirky. Some of it, I don't know what, how do I explain some of it? Okay, young women are sort of different than what I was used to. So I thought this was just perfect for this generation. It's certainly, and it's an eye-opening. I think anyone will enjoy it. You know, we're talking here women power in many ways. That, you know, here Joe was on this, you know, she was headed in one direction. And this whole social media influencing business, I find so fascinating. And so I loved reading about that. What's your background? You were a librarian, right? Or what's your background?
Yeah, I was a school librarian for about 10 years, which was my absolute dream job. And at some point, I assume I will go back. I've been a full-time author for a couple years now.
Yeah, I don't think you're going back, to tell you the truth. I will tell you that. You're headed in different directions, and I have a feeling, as I was reading this book, I get this feeling when I read certain books and I say, okay, well, this is going to be picked up. Somebody's going to film this. That happened when I first, the first time I interviewed Jojo Moyes, I read the book, and I said, okay, this is going to be a film. And I was proven right. You know, it just...
Well, I would love to see this on screen.
Yeah, I have a feeling you would. That's why I don't think you're going to be a librarian. Not going to happen. I am like you. I love libraries, and I've spent so much of my time going around in libraries. And yeah, I was one of those... The kid in school, you know, when I was in grade school, I was the librarian's assistant. So I was always the one who's cataloging.
Yep, as was I.
Oh, I loved it so much. I just loved it. It was, first of all, well, one of the reasons is because I was reading from the time I was 3 years old. So by the time I was in sixth grade, I'd already read all of Jane Austen, for sure. Yeah, so I wasn't exactly the candidate to sit in a regular classroom. And I think it made my teachers nervous because I had read so many more books than they had ever read in their entire lives. So they were happy to let me, you know, you go work for an hour in the library. So I love the Dewey Decimal System. I love it. I knew it so well. It was so much fun to do that. Are you sad that they're going to get rid of it?
I mean, in school libraries, they definitely still use Dewey. But when I go to a public library and they've shifted to, you know, like just general cataloging, it does make me sad.
It does. For people who were raised on the Dewey, I just, I got such a kick out of it, and I was so, it's just still one of the libraries where I would go to, quite a few years ago, was the Rice University Library, and everything was Dewey, and I just go run my hands just along the edges of the books. So Dewey, it's so beautiful.
I know, I love the precision of it.
Exactly.
No matter, yeah, it makes you feel at home. Wherever library you're in, you can find what you're looking for.
I mean, that's the whole point. And as I said, I've traveled the world. I've lived all over the world. But when I went to a library where they had the Dewey, I mean, I could walk exactly to the right shelf, find my book. It makes me sad. It really does. But anyway, back to your book. Which of your three characters did you enjoy writing about the most? I had my own favorite, but which of yours?
I think for me, Autumn, it was my favorite character to write. Like Autumn, I was a huge theater geek as a child and well into high school and college. And I've never actually written someone who was part of the theater. And Autumn is the high school theater teacher, and so she got to have a lot of my opinions.
Well, I liked I like Bianca too, because I started in the theater not very late in life when my boys started doing little theater. And mm-hmm. I had never in school I had never th- I was I, I know it's hard to believe, but I'm a very shy person. And before I started this radio program, I was always the one in the corner reading a book, naturally, but I was shy. And I would never have thought of being in the theater. But when my boys started in little theater, and they were little, and they started with all the, you know, easy things, the Christmas Carol and, you know, Charlie Brown and all those things. And over the years, they got into bigger, you know, productions. I wanted to be on stage. Oh, I worked behind the stage. I did all of the props. I did everything. I'd do anything to get back there because it was so exciting. So I also like that character because there's something so exciting about the theater.
It's a beautiful community. It's really just something you can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, well, and the nice thing about the theater is that there's a job for everybody. You don't have to be, you know, the star. You can be in the background. You can be doing something. There's a job for everybody, and it gets really so I don't know. There's a thrill about it, just that production. When you're in a production, you get so excited. And I know because one day I actually got on stage. I got to be in the chorus of The Fiddle on the Roof.
One of my favorite shows of all time.
I'm telling you, if I would go back, I would have gone into the theater because it's just so much fun. But your book is fun. I can think to myself, I kept thinking, she's having fun writing this book.
Yes, that was the whole goal. I wanted something fun and escapist and just somewhere, a fun place for readers to go. You know, before this, my last book was about witches and death and grief. And
yeah, I know. I had a look at
something it. Totally opposite.
Yeah, yeah. And I am so grateful to you because I am getting too many pandemic-y books. And I recently I got a book. Well, a couple of very famous authors have really included masks as part of the persona of the people, and I can't relate to that. I want to know.
Not ready.
I'm not ready for it, and
I don't want to see it in my fiction. When I still have to wear a mask to the grocery store.
Yeah, no, I don't want it. I'm rejecting those books. I took a few, and then I said, why am I doing this to myself? I don't want to read them. I'm not, and I always read all the books that I review. I never have an author. I've only one time had an author on when I didn't read the book. And that's a very funny story. I'll tell people about that sometime. time how I faked that and why I did it. But that's the only time I ever did it. I have to read the book. And I'm not going to read books like that. And particularly, and those two people out there who are listening, and I know they are listening, who sent me the leprosy books, forget it. I'm not interested. I want another book by Lily Anderson because she's got a sense of humor and she's witty and clever, a really fantastic writer. So
you're making me blush.
Well, I'm sure you are working on something, and I want you to promise, because as I said, there's a few books that I get along, you know, during the year. I will say this one really should be a film. And I know that this one is going to be a film, and you have to invite me to the red carpet. Is that?
I certainly will.
Okay, you promise.
I promise. It's on air.
Okay, and I'm going to keep my fingers crossed, and I will actually put that on my website. You'll see. In a few days, I'll send you a link to this interview, and I will have there in big letters, Hollywood, wake up. Put this on film. How about that?
I would love that. You know, this is a Disney published book.
I know. They have to just take it and just, you know, get it going so that you now will never have to think about getting a job as a librarian again. And you can just keep writing and writing and find some joy in life, and you have, and some silliness, and just share that. I think it's that's one of the wonderful things about being a writer. You can really change people's mood, and you changed my mood one day when I started reading this book.
Oh, I'm so glad. That is exactly when I started writing this book what I wanted to happen.
And by the way, the narrator of the Audible is fantastic. I don't have her name.
Tiana Camacho.
Oh, yeah. Unbelievable. I could listen to that voice for hours. Beautiful, beautiful.
Yes, I completely agree. They sent me a list of like 4 auditions, and I heard her voice and was like, oh, I want to hear her read everything.
That's what I thought. I said, she can come to my house and just read some of these books I'm getting. She can, maybe she can read the pandemic-y books to, and maybe she could make them interesting. So she's fantastic. And so are you. Lily Anderson. And you have a web page. Oh, am I supposed to introduce you as Miss Lily? Ms. Lily?
No. When I was working, when I was a school librarian, my students would find my work and thus my first name. And so they would all start calling me, oh, Lily. I said, no. It's Ms. Anderson. And so now that's on all of my social media. So my website is MsLilyAnderson.com.
Okay. And on social media and all of that, they can find you as Ms. Lily.
Yes.
I think that's cute. I think it's adorable. Well, you're cute and you're adorable. And I think it's just fun. It's fun that an author will put a smile on my face. And you certainly have done that today. So thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. And remember, I get that invitation to the red carpet because I have my fingers crossed for you. Okay.
I won't forget. You're the first one who believed in me.
Oh, I'm sure there are many. Well, all of your family must be so proud of you.
Oh, they're all right.
Okay, yeah, what the heck. They're happy, actually, that you didn't move home and live in the basement. So you've done okay.
Exactly. They're very glad that the books pay my bills.
That's it. Okay. Thank you so much for being on the paper, on Joy on Paper today, because you are a joy. Lily Anderson.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Let's do commercials. We'll do commercials. Okay.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Okay, I'm back for a few minutes. I don't have very long. I just want to remind you again that for all of you NaNoWriMo workers and busy bees out there typing away, writing away, check out my webpage, radio-joy on paper, and go and listen to some of Jim Lem's wonderful examples of writing elements that you should know about, and it'll give you some ideas, and it will definitely open your mind to possibilities. Do you know what alliteration is? You will find out if you go to that page and listen to Jim Lamb, because he does a really great job. Everybody, it was a busy day today. Anyway, I'm glad that we did get Kara Cooney on, and it's a fascinating, she has an interesting concept. I will tell you, she's more hopeful than I am, I think. But anyway, it is a fascinating book. And, of course, all of the Egyptology is just, well, I love it. I just love it. Meanwhile, remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, to hear them in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry, because I love her books and I love her new Haunted Haven mysteries, because they're set here. It's book number two is going to come out, I don't know when, but book number one is already out and you can get it, and it's called Be My Ghost, and it's set right here in our neighborhood here in Clearwater, St. Petersburg area. Really fantastic. Say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, because he did everything for me and he kept me from getting nervous when people don't call in on time. Anyway, and he saluted me and I saluted him, because I should have been a general. And there I'm talking about power, and I would have been so good. Oh, what a general I would have made. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. It's going to be beautiful everywhere. Well, I think most places. Anyway, even if it's cold outside, get a book, read, enjoy yourself. Bye-bye.